This is a podcast of the National Maritime Museum of Ireland. The Curlew Commemorative Exhibition was opened in the museum in Dunleary on the 27th of May 1994. It marked the 50th anniversary of the rescue of 168 German Navy personnel by the merchant vessel Curlew on December 29th, 1943, 80 years ago. The exhibition was opened by the President of Ireland at the time, Mary Robinson. One of the German Navy cadets rescued at the time, Wolf Dietrich Klüber, wrote a summary document for this occasion, entitled The Story of the German Navy Personnel Interned in Ireland, 1944 to 1945. At the end of 1943, World War II had turned in the Allies' favour. But the war was not yet over. To support essential war industries with scarce raw materials, five German merchant navy vessels left Japan in October 1943. Only one arrived safely in occupied France. To meet the ship first in line and to provide her with anti-aircraft and surface support, the 8th German destroyer flotilla stationed in Bordeaux and the 4th German torpedo boat flotilla from Brest were put on alert in December 22, 1943. They left port on the 23rd to meet the MV Ossono, who had not until then been detected by the Allied forces. While under air attack by British and American planes, the boats met the blockade runner on the 24th at midday west of the Bay of Biscay. The Ossona was escorted safely, in spite of heavy air attacks, to the Gironde River estuary near Bordeaux. She reached there in the early morning of December 26. In order to meet another blockade runner, the Alsterufer, refueling and taking over provisions and ammunition commenced immediately. Without much risk for the crew, the destroyers and torpedo boats left port again in the morning of 27th of December and head for the same meeting point. They reached it by midday of the 28th. Then they fanned out in search for the Alsterufer, not knowing that she had been sunk by a Liberator bomber in the late afternoon of the previous day. Once this became known, the destroyers and torpedo boats were ordered to return to their home base. However, they had long been located by the British air reconnaissance and the British light cruiser Glasgow and Enterprise had been directed to the scene. They sighted the German flotilla about 1300 hours on the 28th. During the sea battle which developed, the cruisers with their steadier gun platforms sank first the destroyer SZ-27 and then the torpedo boats T-25 and 26. The boats were abandoned between 1430 and 1600 hours during a storm with heavy seas. The crew members took to the life rafts and drifted in the Atlantic. During the night and the following day, death took a heavy toll. Many more lives would have been lost but for the Irish merchant vessel Curlew. She passed through the area at the time, carrying a load of oranges from Lisbon in Portugal to Cove. This small vessel, with only 335 tons, under the command of Captain Thomas Donoghue, responded immediately to a call for help by German planes. In spite of the stormy weather and danger to ship and crew, the Curlew changed course entered the area where the lifeboats drifted. Crew members of the Kerloch had to pick up the 168 men they rescued individually from their rafts or pull them to safety from the water. The Kerloch had to maneuver constantly and the crew had to be alert more than 10 hours right into the night. On their way to the port of Cove, the crew of the Kerloch had hardly any food left and no place to sleep. With its cargo of survivors, a number of them badly wounded, the ship arrived in Cove in the early morning hours of January 1, 1944. In theory, the German sailors were probably interned on December 29, 1943, when they were pulled to safety by the crew of a neutral ship. In all practicality, the internment began at New Year's night of 1944. After having dozed in the machine room for many hours, it became apparent around midnight of 31st of December that the ship was about to enter port. The sound of the engines had changed, lights were visible and officials were standing around, which we had not noticed before. I left the shelter of the warm engine room and started to pick up my uniform and shoes. These I had dropped, like most others, on the upper deck before taking refuge in the machine room. Standing on deck again after so many hours of exhaustion and rest, I developed a sense of urgency. I did find my coat, but not my trousers. I was almost in panic because of the thought that I had to wear shirt and jacket only, so I just grabbed a pair of trousers which fitted more or less, abandoning my trousers with a purse and a navy knife. These activities put life back into me. Most of the other German ratings around me were strangers. They came from other boats or other stations on board. First, I had not known that the ship who had picked us up was Irish. When I learned that, I did not know that Ireland was neutral. The language spoken by the crew seemed to be English, but I could not understand a word of that brogue. Finally, more and more lights were visible, and then we took alongside a pier. The docks were cordoned off by the soldiers, and as their dress looked like British uniforms to us, we thought that we were prisoners of war now. Strange as it was, there was no overwhelming joy that we had survived an ordeal. We were reserved and concentrated on what was going on. Marching down the gangway, we fell in line and waited in groups. Many civilians were standing next to the soldiers and then closed in on us. There were friendly words, cigarettes offered, sweets, chocolate bars. The civilians wanted uniform buttons as souvenirs, which we gave them. Everybody was jolly and cheerful. We ourselves kept guarded, but took the chocolates nevertheless. Later we learned that the army had phoned hotels, pubs, bars and dance halls to call back the duty doctors and medical personnel. They were asked to go to the hospital because an Irish ship had arrived carrying German crewmen, survivors picked up from the sea. This announcement had broken up some New Year's Eve parties and brought the people down to the docks. Finally, some army lorries arrived. We were counted and asked to climb onto them. We still thought that we could be sent to a POW camp now. To show that our spirit was not broken, we started some army song. This, like many other things, we were just done because we had learned during training that a good soldier never gives up. The lorries stopped us at some army barracks. There were lights, stacks of sandwiches and tea, and there were beds. When we had wolfed down the sandwiches and tea, exhaustion took over again. In dirty uniforms, we dropped onto a bed, pulled over a blanket and slept. How many hours I slept, I do not know. Slowly we became human beings again. We sorted ourselves out into groups of those who knew each other from board ship. We welcomed the regular meals composed of sufficient and good army food. With hindsight, I realize that most of us were healthy in spite of what we went through and did not even develop a cold. One of the first one to see us after we had recovered was the German ambassador with his wife. It became known then that we were not prisoners but internees. The couple was probably the first time confronted with the reality of war and shocked how young the majority of us were, many just 18 years old. They asked us if we had any wishes, but we had none. After a relative short while, routine developed, as all our uniforms were soaked with salt water and oil. An Irish army tailor took our measurements for the provision of a suit. We were issued with army underwear, army boots and soap, etc. The second important event was the recording of the rescued men. Name, rank, home addresses were taken down by Irish and German officers. We were relieved that there was an organized way that our parents or wives would be notified of our survival. Seeing a copy of the records today hanging in the Curlogue commemorative exhibition at the Maritime Institute in Dunleary, one realizes that many names were misspelled, including mine. This had caused some anxiety to my parents until the real names were verified after 6 weeks. It is of further interest that at a very early time the names of those rescued were read out by Soldatensender Kalle, the English broadcasting in German language. This station addressed the German armed forces in France and civilians in Germany. None of the officers of the Z-27 had been rescued. The highest ranking officer was Lieutenant Commander Kledenfeld, commander of the T-26. He spoke English well, since he served in the Merchant Navy before the war. All of us had lost personal friends, but this was not discussed during these days in Ireland. We were too busy to fall into our new life, young, and maybe it also was self-protection. The guards from the army were friendly and they took interest in us and we in them. They brought cigarettes and sweets and changed them for souvenirs, mainly uniform buttons and the eagle from our jacket. The guards were the first link to the outside world. Soon we were marched outside the barracks and across the compound. One evening a friend of mine called me outside. He introduced me to a sergeant major who had brought army coats and army caps. We put them on and we were brought to the mess of the NCOs. Here we were the center of interest to these men. We were queried about the battle events, asked about the hours we spent on the raft and about the rescue, how we were picked up. Even with our school English, we must have spun a good yarn because there was stout for us, stuff we had never tasted before. This outing was not a single affair, but was repeated a couple of times. During one of the earlier days in Cork, all of us developed stomach cramps and diarrhea. It was around midday that this started and we all queued up for the few lavatories. This was real violent and often it was not possible to reach the lavatory in time. Of course, when the attack was over, we cleaned up the mess. This incident was recalled by every Navy veteran I talked to in May. No explanation was at hand as to what had triggered off the disease. Maybe the bacon, fat, or other food, as we've had no real food for many days. This easy life in Cork came to an end when our suits arrived. Dark blue, almost black, and army-type material. They fitted well and allowed us to clean our own uniforms. A few days later we departed. I cannot recall if by rail or lorry to the Curragh camp. Some stayed behind who were badly wounded in the hospital. To those, they attached some of the cadets as interpreters and assistant orderlies to help the army nurses. Two of the veterans I talked to stated that they stayed in Cork until April. One looked after an NCO who was badly burnt by steam in the engine room. There was little hope that he would survive, but survive he did, thanks to the commitment of the doctors and nurses and his own will to live. Those two interpreters and orderlies assisted in his care around the clock. They were soon well known and taken out to pubs and dances. When the army moved us to the Curragh camp, we were allocated to wooden barracks. In army style, there was no subdivision in the long building. Navy ranks were checked in with the second furthest barrack, almost on the end of the main road. The last one was the canteen and recreation barrack. In army tradition, everyone had a bed with four planks, a mattress and four blankets. There were no cupboards, and we stacked our belongings alongside or under the bed. We were then issued with an identification card signed by the commander, Gradenfeld, and countersigned by the comp commander. My ID card was dated 28th of January 1944. The camp was fenced off by barbed wire. Watchtowers were placed along the sides of the camp, and on each corner we had a kitchen barrack where food was prepared by Irish cooks. The meals were taken on wooden tables and benches in front of the kitchen. Food was plentiful: beef, cabbage, gravy, potatoes, but not much variety. Soon, to the disbelief of the responsible supply officer, our commander asked for less beef and more potatoes. This is in a country where potatoes were staple food, but here it was, and the matter was settled. Our own cooks took over from their Irish colleagues, and the kitchen was then run by our own cook until our repatriation. The cooks were permanent and got the supply from the army. Soon, standard Navy food was prepared, with the ranks taking turns in kitchen duties. One other small problem was also solved in the spirit of cooperation. We were issued with steel lockers, which were not normally available to ranks in the Irish Army. It was said that the Irish officers found it hard to believe that with the size of the German armed forces, some number like 5 million lockers existed in Germany. The interior of our barracks were transformed. With some planks and wire, we divided the barracks into small rooms, using blankets as walls and arranging beds alongside these walls. These rooms were called shops, a Navy name for small stores. Normally, 3 to 4 ranks shared a shop. Thoroughways existed, as well as some common space. This arrangement, while rather like a gypsy camp, provided some privacy at a time when we were more or less restricted to the barracks. February 1944 was cold and there was plenty of rain. In spite of our shop, all ranks spent a lot of time in front of the stove. The time was passed with small talk, particularly about girlfriends, cleaning, shining shoes and playing cards. Past events were not discussed. English lessons started for those who had learned English at school. Class was in the room next to the canteen. The teacher was demanding, but a likable man. He pronounces English very correctly. Sometimes thought we were given to escape from Ireland, but never followed through. Living on an island had to be accepted by all of us. A few weeks after we built the shops from blankets, plans were developed by the army authorities to subdivide the barracks in a more orderly way. Soon we found ourselves with 15 cadets in a fairly large room, which was divided by us into a bedroom and a living room. The beds were doubled up, and we used lockers as dividing walls. The living had the stove in the middle. Two round tables existed, and we had sufficient benches and chairs. We were housed at the end of the barrack, close to the wire fence. The rooms had large windows, and some pictures were hung, also lamps, so we felt very comfortable. We maintained strict order with regards to our personal belongings. Everything looked tidy and well cleaned. In front of the barracks, the cooks had rooms and some signal men and wireless operators. They were nice and quiet men and easy to get on with. Often they played skat or doppelkopf with us. We did not enter other barracks normally, particularly not those where our officers or NCOs lived, but the overall approach was friendly. Whenever weather permitted, soccer or volleyball was played in the open spaces. Beside the English lessons, we cadets also received instructions in navigation and later on in meteorology. Next to the canteen, there was a table tennis room, utilized by all. As mentioned before, the Navy personnel had been issued with ID card in January. With the issue of these cards, a parole system was developed. It allowed us to leave the camp and move freely within a radius of 12 miles. Curfew was normally 12 midnight. Later on, we also allowed to visit Dublin once a month, and curfew was extended up to 2 a.m. on special request to allow for occasions when all-night dances were on. First, we went out in groups and marched to the gymnasium or the indoor swimming pool to have some workouts. Particularly, we cadets marched accompanied by an officer. When marching, we often used to sing songs like Heckelrosen or Ein Hello Ein Batzen. The Irish must have wondered what was going on, since the refrains were rather simple words like Heidi Hi, but sung with great enthusiasm. They accepted it, however, with a smile. As soon as we were really settled in the camp, we also ventured out on our own. We were easily identified in our dark blue suits. Soldiers or civilians approached us for friendly chats about the weather. "Nice day, isn't it?" or "Have a smoke," were the first phrases every sailor understood. At times, we strolled over to the Air Force camp and chatted with our fellow internees. They had learned, of course, about our rescue and were generally helpful. They gave us useful advice on the do's and don'ts island. Through them, we heard about Newbridge and its races and about Kildare, Naas, and Saturday night dances. Of course, we thought that some of these Air Force men had developed lagercholle, eccentric behaviour. But most of them we found to be interesting men. They were older and had more life experience. We got to know them much better when they were moved into our camp around May or June. Particularly, some of their officers took interest in us cadets and provided lectures. There was a senior sergeant who had been a flight instructor and crash-landed so often that he had not a straight bone left. His nose was flat, like that of a boxer, but we had also a good story and a ready smile. Two of the officers were meteorologists. One of them used to work in the movie business. Our lives changed substantially once we received our monthly military pay through our embassy, an amount of £1.10 a month. The first payment was more because it included back pay. We used the money for small purchases such as soap and toothpaste, as well as shirts and pullovers. Once in a while, we visited the local cinema. It held a lot of attraction to us because the cashier was the owner's daughter. She was a good-looking, dark-haired girl. We also met civilians there, camp families, and on a Saturday night the crowds mingled in the entrance hall. We loved to sit at the balcony upstairs. It was more expensive and therefore less crowded. Smoking was allowed in the cinema. Besides the main feature, there was the weekly news and the front runs like music by big show orchestras with Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey. Films with Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney were great attractions. Everybody loved them, and they're unforgettable for me and my gal. As the weather improved by the end of March, we started jobbing individually. Some nearby farmers needed help for cutting the hedges, building roads, digging, painting, or other jobs. We did whatever they wanted. Cutting hedges was the worst job because often one didn't hit in the right angle and the cutting knives then jumped off the stems when the risks were hurting terribly. But anything for some extra money. Quite a bit of those extra funds went to the sweet shops for Cadbury chocolate bars. There was a tea room and sweet shop just around the corner from the cinema. It was run by two spinsters who liked to chat with us. One of them was called Mutti. She had some extra Cadbury bars funds every time we called. Chocolate was semi-rationed during those war days. Regularly, one could only buy one bar per purchase. After our worst language problems had been overcome, Kildare and Newbridge held a lot of attraction. There were tea rooms, pubs, hotel bars. There was also a military post in Kildare, just outside the main town. We used to meet some NCOs from the post regularly in the bar of the railway hotel. Every week on Wednesday, which was the army's payday, the bar was crowded. These NCOs liked to buy us a stout or two, and we used to sing Irish and German songs with them. Sometimes at these parties, one whiskey, one stout, or one stout, one whiskey, one stout. The way up the Curra seemed to be long. We had to hurry across the fields in order to be back before curfew. We had a saying about army pay. Wednesday and Thursday, pub. Friday and Saturday, cinema. Sunday, church. And Monday, Tuesday, waiting for payday. Ireland was really poor those days, but it was as fun just as well. Kildare had an even more popular cinema than the Curra. It was more expensive and we did not go up to the balcony. One of the movies we liked a lot was a coloured picture, The Phantom of the Opera, now a famous musical. Newbridge was less lively, but it had the racecourse and some beautiful public parks. We went over there mostly on Saturdays to watch the races. We found races very interesting, although we could not pay for the stands. There were always plenty of people around, including nice-looking young ladies, dressed up in the latest fashion. We knew nothing about betting at that time. One day in late April 1944, we called out to the compound and asked if we wanted to work in the bog. It was explained to us that this was work for May, June and August, regular work if we did it well. This job had been arranged by one of the Air Force officers who knew the owner of the bog. Altogether, 60 or 70 of us volunteered for the job. Early in the morning, around 6 o'clock, turf lorries were standing in the front of the gate and we climbed on. We were standing, holding on to the wooden sides. The road to the bog was winding and often the lorry braked suddenly because of sheep blocking the road. We loved these early morning drives, although at times it was still cold and raining. The bog area was wide and one could see up to the horizon. Cutting turf was done by local workers. They were lean, tough men. The foreman met us, marked our worksheets, and then we went over to our cutter. He was facing a turf bank with a sharp, two-edged spade, a slain. With one sweep, he cut into the bank and brought up a sod, which we grabbed in mid-air and placed it on the ground for the first try. We worked in groups of two. All of the work was piecework. We made between £2.10 to £4.10 a week, depending on how much time could not be worked due to the rain. The average take-home money was about £3.10. The slightly dried sods were later footed into stacks. Each stack consisted up to 4 to 6 verticals, slightly on angle, and 4 sods on top of those crosswise. The footed sods looked like rows of toy soldiers. They were well in line. About 2 weeks later, these sods were arranged in beehives. This work required some skill, and when a beehive fell, one could hear good old English swear words across the otherwise peaceful bog. We loved our tea time and lunch breaks, and after an 8-hour workday, 6 days a week, we went to bed early. The first work was finished by late June, and life was back to normal. In early August, we went out again to take the dried turf from the beehive to stack them up by the road. This was done by wooden wheelbarrows with a plank crate. They were filled up to the top and weighed heavily, and there were long distances to cover. We were well tanned, with a healthy complexion, and felt good, particularly with our earnings. Every day during these weeks, thinking ahead of winter time, we collected the broken up pieces of bark brown turf, which was almost like lignite. They were carefully stacked in the camp in order to keep dry. In this way, we had plenty of fuel for colder days. There were a number of developments because we were well off now. The first we did was to buy bicycles. In order not to spend too much, they were bought second-hand, and mostly one bike for two cadets. A second-hand bike was £3 to £6 in those days. These bikes were made us quite mobile, like our Air Force men, and allowed us to go on to places like Nez or Athy. It gave us a lot of freedom. The next thing we did was to buy ourselves an extra suit. A tailor-made suit cost £6 to £7, and we now looked like civilians. If it was not a suit, it was a jacket to go along with trousers of the suit supplied by the army. The greatest thing for us was a radio for our room. Its use was controlled by one cadet in turn for 1 week. It kept us in touch with the world. Irish and English broadcasts were received and on shortwave with the help of the wireless operators. We raised Germany. Otherwise, there was no luxury for us. Money was saved. As summer approached, particularly in July 1944, we used the swimming pool in small groups. Also, soccer was played on the Currus soccer training ground towards Newbridge. It was like bird watching to see the schoolgirls playing hurling. We found it amazing how well these girls played and how daring. Of course, we had to stay clear of the teacher and stay well away of the playing fields. Playing around the side of the swimming pool one day, I was involved in an accident. Other cadets had pushed me into the water, and when I came up face first, they pushed in a friend of mine. He jumped head on, not seeing me, and then ended up in my face. I had a broken nose and my neck was hurting. He had concussion and a wound in his skull. We were lucky that this was all the damage. We were brought to the hospital for checkup, and we kept there for treatment and observation. The wound had to be stitched, and my nose needed some setting. My neck was not broken, though. A few days later, we could have gone back to the barrack, bar for the doctor in charge. He used our stay to improve his German. Not so long ago, he had learned from a German circus artist who had been found spying and was interned in a different camp. In his off time, we were lecturing, the doctor in German. We lay in one of the wards with about 30 men. One of them, another German sailor, had a broken foot from a soccer game. We got well on with the Irish soldiers who crowded around and also introduced us to the game of Rummy. We used to cheat in order not to lose any money. As they did not speak any German, we used to pretend singing, whereby we indicated what cards we needed to get ahead, and the other one did his best to help. A few pennies were made that way, but of course the cheating was detected after a while and we had to pay stout in the evening. After we were finally discharged, the doctor invited us to come to Dublin, where his family stayed, and we visited him there occasionally. In the summer of 1944, after first term in the bog and most other internees working somewhere, we went to the local dances once in a while. We also travelled to more distant places to attend local festivals. Dancing in those days was very popular. Girls were sitting on one side of the dance hall, boys on the others. When the music started, the boy got up and asked one of the girls for the dance. Once the music stopped, the partner was left standing in the dance floor and returned to her place unaccompanied. There were chaperones for the girls, but there was also the opportunity once in a while to meet the girl in front of the dance hall and have a chat. That was the way during those days. We German sailors were novelties the first weeks we showed up, but local girls were prudent enough to realize that we would depart the day the war was over. We were, of course, very keen in visiting local festivals. There were Irish dancing competitions with fiddles and banjos and tin whistles. Often they were rugby or hurling games, and everyone was in a festive mood. The all-night dances which followed those festivals were normally could not attend due to the curfew hours. When the days became shorter again, less work was available. Often we were tired of reading or playing card, and we went up to the soldiers' cinema not far from the main camp gate. In this movie house, the films changed up to 3 times a week, and the entrance fee was only 3 pence. There were 3 wooden benches, but they did not bother us. Often we did not know which movie was shown, just lined up at the cashier and hoped for the best. And the best was quite often. We watched such stars as Rita Hayworth, Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire, James Mason, and many others. We liked the feature films like Our Little Gang, and we always saw the latest newsreels. The soldier cinema was to us what television is today. A lot of commercial talents developed in our camp, mostly used to overcome idleness, but then turned into commercial arrangements. Let's start with the cook from Hamburg. He was a small, thin man. When nearly all of us worked on paid jobs, the German camp commander raised the level for the cook in order to keep him and his helpers on kitchen duty. The kitchen was well run and meals were offered punctually on the minute. The cook was an expert on horse racing. In his free time, he studied all the racing papers available and placed his bets with the bookie, mostly for the Newmarket races in England, which took place on Wednesdays and Saturdays. His secret was to bet outsiders with good pedigree from Ireland on place. He maintained that he had a steady income from the results of his betting. He cautioned us not to bet in Newbridge, as their 2-year-old horses were racing with no experience or previous record. The next venture to mention was the donut production of our 2 NCOs. They baked in their own barrack in a special room. Dough was prepared by them, while the sugaring and filling with jam was carried out by paid helpers. First, the doughnuts were sold in the camp to fellow internees. We were tempted by the good smell of fresh doughnuts and held one for breakfast once in a while. Later, some local bakeries ordered doughnuts. Big Mrs. was done on Saturdays, when about 10 of us sold doughnuts at the race course in Newbridge for them. The price was 3 pence, and business was going well. There were no such things as Coca-Cola, candy bars, or other sweets available these times. We, the vendors, mainly cadets, received 0.5 for each doughnut sold. With 150 to 200 sold on a racing day, it was well worth the trouble. The bakery was quite good business and good food anyway. The barbershop was another activity. In the early days, one of our machinists had turned barber. He did haircuts well, and we went to him instead of using outside barbers. He later trained a second man and had a well-equipped shop, charging 3 pence for a haircut. However, the biggest business venture was founded by two NCOs who had pre-war experience in the shoe industry. How they started the business, I don't remember, but as shoes were rationed in Ireland and apparently no production existed for ladies' pumps, the shoe industry flourished. Making shoes turned out a medium-sized industry. Leather was available in Ireland, and so was the dye. It needed the know-how and organizing talents of two internees to start this business. For those who ordered pumps, there were little risk. The investment required was moderate, as a lot was done by hand. There was a totally unsatisfied market. I remember that our shoe fabrication first was looked upon by the guards with some suspicion. But as they were convinced that everything was done legally, I suppose, no taxes were paid, regular delivery of materials and export of boxes with shoes was no problem. The shoe factory provided a fair number of our men with employment. A funny thing happened when one day the two industrialists stood in front of the camp with a second-hand motor car and asked permission to enter. Even that problem was overcome by the internment camp authorities. The two NCOs became well-to-do but had to follow camp regulations as everyone else. The only thing noticeable to us, more modest working-class men, were the elegant suits they were wearing. When they left Ardley, finally, a contract was made by the two to run the car as a taxi in Dublin. When the Rady was bought for our room, one talent emerged nobody had known about. One of our cadets picked up the latest songs and melodies and as soon knew the tune. He was a very gifted piano player and knew all about notes, keys, and other things required for a real musician. He could take down the notes of a tune from the radio. He listened to the tune whenever it was repeated on the radio and soon had the notes correctly on paper. When the song was properly set for the various instruments and the words were noted down, this cadet was the life and drive of our camp band and was nicknamed McNamara. My name is McNamara and I'm the leader of the band. I do not know when the band was first formed and how they had obtained their instruments, piano, accordion, guitar, bass and drums. They used to practice in the recreation room every morning and had a rich repertoire. In summer 1944, they made their first appearance in the dance hall in the Curra camp. This was an immediate success and soon they had contracts for all-night dances, not only in the Curra, but in places like Naas, Kildare and others. The advantage they had vis-a-vis other bands was that they were able to play the latest hits right when they were on the air. The band played very well indeed, though they did not make the same type of money as the shoe factory did, but they lived well and had good fun with their show business. As the second winter started, life in the camp centered around the stove again. With our provision of turf pebbles, the cold could not bother us this time. We had plenty of fuel, and often the stove was red hot. The radio was playing, we were reading or writing. Mail now arrived regularly. But the news about the war was not good. It became clear to us that the war was not going well. We bought the Illustrated London News and read the weekly notes on the war written by Little Hard. But as we were now out of the war, we could do nothing and were too far away to worry. During this winter, many tournaments were started, table tennis, card games, chess and others. Often we had to plan ahead to meet the schedule. Christmas was passed with plenty of food. The army provided turkey and our cooks prepared the stuffing. Donuts were bought and recipes for cookies tried out. We also started to go to lectures again. Everything to overcome the rain and the dark. The Red Cross Library was well stocked with German books, but we tried to read English books as well. I succeeded to read in English quite well, which later in post-war Germany proved to be a great asset. Sometimes we also took interest in our next-door neighbours, the men from the IRA. In actual fact, we had done it before. At times we heard them singing. Sometimes we stood on the far end of the camp and they at the end of theirs. We could see them and there was some waving and hellos. Overall, we did not know much about them or their political motivations. We were told that they didn't want to commit themselves not to go to the north again. That would have been against their honour. But we did not understand the IRA story and there was not much information available. Our camp guards were on duty 24 hours and we knew them quite well. They stayed at the front gate where they were established. They did not normally enter the camp. We always gave them the time of day or exchanged some jokes. We did not know them or their families and tried not to give them problems. I think all of us appreciated that their duty was done efficiently and quietly and that earned them our respect. Late March 1945, the crew of a submarine arrived in Ireland and was first brought to our camp. I do not remember if they stayed with us for the rest at the Carrick camp. Many of them were even younger than we were. All of them were mentally near exhaustion. Their hands were shaking and they had a haunted look. They did not tell us what had happened to them and there was no real communication with them. Maybe to them we looked like having the lager collar, a kind of madness. When the war was finally over, there were many discussions in our group of what would happen in Germany and to us. Nobody knew. There was the feeling that all prisoners of war could be sent to Russia. Others held hope that they could stay in Ireland. As we were too far from the scene, we just carried on for the time being. To worry would not have helped anyone, and a wait-and-see attitude developed. We were glad when the work in the bog started again, particularly as our embassy had closed and the basic pay was stopped. Our Irish friends worried with us and tried to cheer us up. The day that Germany surrendered in May 1945, we had sold donuts on the race course again. When the races were over, I went with a pal to a small place where drinks were served. A group of three or four army officers with some young ladies were there. They had apparently won some money on the races. They had a few drinks and were enjoying themselves. When we entered the bar, they invited us for a drink, and one of the ladies said to us, "Go to America, boys. Go there. That's where the money is." How much we would have liked to go, but we knew that for us the way to the States was via Germany. We drank to her health nevertheless. Life inside and outside the camp was much the same when the war had ended. We had no idea what would happen to us and when we would be repatriated. The officers from the Air Force were more informed than we, because they had friends in Dublin, but they also were no more knowledgeable in political affairs than ourselves. My doctor friend from Dublin came up for a few days on duty in the car again. He was positive that life would go on in Germany sooner than we thought. His advice was that Germany should stay with the Western powers and become more predictable by joining the democracies and working for the rebuilding of Germany. How right he was. Rumors that our time in Ireland would come to an end started to circulate in July. Still, nobody knew a date. We started to sell things like our bicycles as prices dropped steadily. When the news came out that we would depart the next morning, the camp was closed and parole cancelled. With the toleration of the Curragh guards, however, some sort of bazaar still went on in front of the gates. Prices, though, had collapsed almost completely. There were also many friends visiting us and coming to bid farewell. One of our cadets decided that his bicycle should accompany him to Germany. He stripped it totally, made a parcel of it, the wheels and the frame, and the handles were sticking out to carry it. He even succeeded to get it to Germany. Early in the morning on Monday of August, there was the departure. We were content and felt it was time to go home, if ever it still existed. Some had come from parts like East Prussia or Silesia, now overrun by the Russians. The guards who had looked after us so well, the camp commander and all our friends were there to wave us off. We did not know if we were to cry or to laugh. The bus took us through the green parts of Ireland we knew so well, Newbridge, Naas, Dublin, right to the port. There we departed from the buses, lined up on the pier and again boarding a ship, this time to take us away from Ireland, the country who had been so kind to us and we had learned to love. More to say, it had been the Irish people who had looked after us with care and consideration. From Ireland we were brought by an English hospital ship to Ostend in Belgium. The passage was without events. In Ostend we were taken by US ammunition trucks to a POW camp near Brussels. There the internees were kept as POWs for about 2 to 3 months until released to their homes in Germany. To mark the 50th anniversary of our rescue, three cadets who had stayed in touch decided to look for those cadets who had shared the room in the Curragh camp. By good luck, chances and fortunate breaks, six were found. Our reunification with Germany had made it possible. One other had been found recently and four had passed away. Our first reunion was arranged between nine cadets in March 1993, which was even attended by two from the eastern part of Germany. In January 1994, an invitation from the Maritime Institute of Ireland for the opening of the Curragh Commemorative Exhibition arrived, and all nine of us, former cadets, accepted this invitation. The programme included a visit to the Curragh camp, where we were received with typical Irish hospitality. One of the former cadets summed up our feelings. We were treated in this camp well and with remarkable fairness. The guards did their duty in a friendly manner. Moreover, most of them tried to make us feel at home. This attitude was also to the credit of Commander James Guiney, whom I do want to mention and remember with gratitude. Here ends the reflective account written by Wolf-Dieter Kluber all those years ago.